20 p.m. here on WGTD HD. And if you'd like to be featured on Noon Tunes, send me an email, mcgrathd@gtc.edu. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave McGrath for Saturday Noon Tunes.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, and welcome to Education Matters. I'm your host this week, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And I'm very happy to introduce my guest today. It is none other than Don Weissenen, professor in the Baruch College, City University of New York, Marks School of Public and International Affairs. He has received the Presidential Award for Distinguished Teaching and Distinguished Scholarship, which is a good thing given the nature of our program. He teaches courses and workshops in public communication, including executive speech training, communication strategy, and seminars on storytelling, conflict and negotiation, and leadership and improvisation. All of his research seeks to understand how communication works to promote or hinder the force of citizens' voices. Since, in the words of Walter Annenberg, every human advancement or reversal can be understood through communication, he has written over 45, I think it's over 50 now, scholarly publications on the subject, covering topics from strategies in public speaking to the ways that organizations and governments can better communicate with different stakeholders. He is the author of Improv for Democracy, How to Bridge Differences and Develop the Communication and Leadership Skills Our World Needs, and forthcoming books on the intersections of strategic communication and voter suppression. That one might be out already. Participatory Budgeting and Nonprofit Leadership. We'll catch up after the intro. Previously, Don worked in broadcast journalism as a speech writer and continues to develop and run communication campaigns for organizations across the private and public sectors. He's founder of Communication Upward, and maybe we can learn a little more about that. He's also an adjunct lecturer at Columbia University and at New York University. For the last two decades, he's also been a comedy writer and improvisational comedian at theaters in Los Angeles and New York. Welcome, Don Weissenen.
Hey, Jonathan. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be on the program.
Oh, fantastic. I've been looking forward to this opportunity because I think, as you know, mutual friend introduced us, and I also have an interest in something I call theater of empowerment, of storytelling, dialogue, and performance for personal and social development. So we have lots in common. I can't wait to dig in now and hear your take on what you're doing. You say, just to get us rolling here, that communication is at the center of every challenge human beings face. Wow. So can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Yeah, and I have to add there, given what you just said, I think that actually theater in some ways and performance are at the center of what we are doing. Essentially, these are not peripheral matters. And a lot of my projects are about really refocusing these at the center of human thinking and action in many ways. So, yeah, I think there's just that, whether it's a minor interpersonal conflict between people to major policy problems, it's my contention that everything can be connected to the quality of the stories that people are telling. And we're always telling stories. Human beings never let meanings just take place in a vacuum. We're always doing that. And I think not only the quality of the stories we tell, but the types and forms of communication that we're using to talk about anything. Those are the worlds that we live in, the worlds we create with our voices, with our images, with our music, with all kinds of symbol systems. And so refocusing that in 2023 especially is a central project of mine.
So you mentioned storytelling as a very important form of communication. It's kind of ubiquitous. Someone, I forget who, said we live in stories. I guess more than one person has said that. You mentioned in your LinkedIn profile that you work on something called strategic storytelling. And what? How can we be more strategic in our storytelling?
Yeah, and a lot of my work is the students that I work with and outside clients of the organization I consult with is about helping people tell their stories better, and I think in more ethical and effective ways, ultimately. In the field of communication and just talking about communication in a lot of the public discourse, we've come to call everything story. See that call it? Everything's a story. Well, yes, but also story historically is conflict creating change. It's a character or characters facing conflict, and it's about the transformation they undergo, or the person undergoes, the character undergoes, as a result of going on a journey where lots of good things happen, lots of negative things happen, but that journey is key. So one of the things I do a lot with is try to help nonprofits especially tell their stories in a way that they are actually telling the story, and they're not just touting their successes, but they're actually bringing people into the story of what they, the work that they're doing. Just to give you a quick example of this, I was working with the Women's Sports Foundation recently, which has been the advancing Title IX women's sports for 50 years now. And if it weren't for their efforts, and this is an organization started by Billie Jean King, I was just amazed at what this team of staff have done to, you know, try to achieve equality in sports and bring more, women's sports into high school, things like that. And I was talking with them just about telling these stories, and they've got so many stories to tell. And about bringing, particularly audiences that may not know about their stories into that story. I think that's fundamentally what we're always doing. We're casting a net, a wide net with our words and saying, come into my story. But I think we can sometimes do that better than we do, or stories get submerged or not told or hidden, or there's power pressures not to say, something given certain audiences. And so that's an ongoing continuous project for all of us, I think, is what are ethical and effective narratives that this world needs to hear?
So you've hinted at some of these dimensions. One is making a story more inclusive. If you had a list of qualities of good stories, what else would you have on that list?
I think inclusive is probably at the top there, and because I think we also need to get serious that there are horrendous stories that human beings have told that have led to some of the worst things that have happened on this planet. Those have also been the result of stories, right? There's a wonderful TED talk called The Dangers of a Single Story. What happens when we only tell one story? It'd be problematic, right? That's the story of fascist regimes. Those are the stories of any kind of totalitarian government. There are no other stories but this one story, right? So inclusion is absolutely at the top. I think telling an open story, telling a story where we're leaving room and space open for other stories to be told, is really key, while also saying it's important to own our story, right? So I think that really is key. Story with a sense of standpoints. Story that this sense that there's so many standpoints out there, and a sense that there is endless storytelling available. I love, just to cap this off, I don't know if you ever heard of James Carse. He was a religion scholar for many years, and he had this idea that he said, evil is the termination of infinite play. That evil is not the inclusion of finite games in an infinite game, but this is key, but the restriction of all play to one or another finite game. And he's using the word game there, but I think we could say stories, right? Evil is the termination of infinite stories. So Primarily, yes, storytelling should be inclusive and keep seeking broader stories beyond itself.
Fantastic. Another form of communication, which overlaps, doesn't exclude storytelling, is improvisation.
Yes.
At the frame. That's very, very important to your work. Maybe you could tell us a little about that.
Yeah, improv. So what is improv? It's a loaded term, because when I bring it up, and I'll be honest with you, even when I say to folks, oh, we're going to do some teaching or training that's based in improv, all kinds of associations come up. Oh, is this going to be silly? Is it comedy? Do I have to be funny? There's all these expectations. Is this just winging it, right? And actually, improvisation, and this isn't just me, this goes back to, I think, to Viola Spolin, who was one of the progenitors of improv in the United States across the past century, really established a foundation for this. Bernard and Short say that improv is connecting, responding, and reacting at a heightened level with others. And for me, that's the heart of this. Improv is just getting much more attuned and emotionally connected to what is happening between oneself and other people in any situation, and really trying to read subtext. Improv is looking at it this way, you know, a sort of heightened sense of observing, connecting, and responding with others is the knowledge and performance gap we have in a lot of formal educational systems. It's that side of things that we don't often attend to in a lot of education. Give you an example. There's this wonderful exercise. It's very easy. I have an executive MBA class every year. My first class, I say, get up on your feet and just count the numbers 1, 2, and 3 back and forth to each other, right? And you keep going 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and I say, go as fast as possible. They implode. These are students who have taken courses in finance, statistics, accounting. Numeracy is not a problem for them, but getting up with another human being and doing 1, 2, and 3 back and forth fast, they start blaming each other. Their heads explode. Their body language. I tell them after, I say nonverbals, they're holding it tight. Their shoulders are tense. Their voices are constricted sometimes in doing this. And I say, this shows that the skills of reading a room, adapting to other people well, and, you know, finding confidence and comfort in yourself is often not emphasized in a lot of education. Improv-based teaching and training is here to – that's the intervention point we're making here, is to get into those human skills that maybe you haven't had as much training in, but that this is a means toward that end. That's what improv is for me.
Oh, fantastic. So – you bring improv into all of your classes?
Now I do. And so for anybody listening going like, what would I do? I wrote Improv for Democracy as an A to Z curriculum for anyone who's like, I want to roll out more communication curricula or leadership training curricula, and especially civic education, kind of civic engagement training. It's written on those three levels. But there is a minimalist version of this too, which is just throw in one of these games or exercises in a class. I don't like calling them icebreakers. I think that minimizes their importance. But to establish a quick positive climate in the room, sometimes I have people just do, let's do rock, paper, scissors. And then if you win, you go face somebody else who won. But the person who lost has to turn to you and be your wing person, chanting your name and going, yay, like supporting. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the class is supporting someone else as people battle it out. And I use that just to show, I say, what was the climate in this room like before we did this exercise? Oh, it was tense. It was nervous. There was a negative space. And I said, what happened when we did this? Oh, it feels positive. Our peripheral vision has widened. We're seeing each other in a different way. I've done this in workplaces where people go, I'm seeing a different side of my coworker even, right? So just these slight interventions, whether you're teaching math or geography or history or anything at all, whatever it is you're teaching, I think we can use these kinds of exercises and games to build a climate that's positive, supportive. And ultimately, as I had one participant say in a training, this was from her, it makes it hard to hate. That might be the slogan for all of this, actually. Why do this? Because it makes it really hard to hate. You kind of strip out that space of really seeing others as others and seeing others as providing offers to build off of in any kind of subject or class. So we could go down a deep rabbit hole with that, but that's
this
just
is good.
You know,
no,
minimum
really
to maximum stuff you can do with this, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, as I hear you talk about that wonderful exercise, and I agree that the word icebreaker is kind of minimizes the creative potential of what's going on when people are doing these some of these games and exercises. However, I can see also how it's possible to think of the improv slash game slash exercise moment as a precursor or warm up to getting into the course content, and these two things being discrete, different moments in a classroom. I get the sense that you do something more than having improv as a discrete moment.
Yeah, every improvised exercise I do in a class is tied to some kind of high-level meaningful concept that ultimately gets at practices, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that improv does is it takes students from just working at a cognitive level and intellectualizing content to more of a cognitive, affective, and behavioral level of engagement with a subject.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a parallel here would be, I think in politics, we use the word ideology too much.
Mm-hmm.
When we really need a term that gets at physiology. There's lots of research showing that ideas are not just up in our brains. They are embodied. We are embodied beings. You know, how we're feeling, our affect plays into political polarization and things like that. Are the behaviors we engage in verbally, non-verbally. So this is the kind of, I had a mentor once that put it this way. It's the kind of learning that occurs by the nervous system. Saying, you know, how do we get learning more deeply into the body? How do we make it not just sitting and listening passively? There's over 1,000 studies supporting active learning. I know almost all educators believe in this now, but we go back historically, the Greeks, you know, there was a time in Greece when education was, you'd have a teacher and we'd all walk and talk it out. There was no class. The classroom was just, let's go walk and talk. And so it was recognized that motion, the body, is actually connected to memory. It's connected to our processing. And so that's even that, just getting the body moving, getting people looking at each other in different ways, I think can be incredibly important. So I use this primarily for communication and leadership training, but I think it can apply to different contexts as well.
So what's one way that you use it for leadership training?
I use it in leadership training as a to put people in, I would call it in between spaces where they have to adapt to others quickly, right? There's a wonderful metaphor from adaptive leadership theory, Heifetz, Gershow, and Linsky, that great leadership is alternating between the balcony, looking at a bird's eye view, trying to get a high level perspective, being on the balcony and the dance floor. Meaning you're in the action, you're talking to people, you're not just in a side office removed from everyone. You know, if you're the president of a college, you're having conversations with the custodial staff because they see things you will never see, right? You can see how inclusion plays into this quite a bit as well. But that, you know, being on the balcony and being on the dance floor are really key. So I have an exercise, and I got this from others in the Applied Improvisation Network. It's a kind of a global organization where these tools are tested and refined and used in education and training contexts. This wonderful exercise where everybody, it's called Sun and Moon. I love this. So you're in a circle and you say, okay, pick one person in the group. They're going to be your sun and someone else is your moon. Okay. And when I say go, at all times, your goal is to have the moon in between yourself and the sun. So it's chaotic, right? You can imagine, go, everybody goes and they're moving around and it's just chaos in the room or the space that you're within. And then I say, okay, round two, we're going to do the same thing, but I want you to slow down. Let's do this in slow motion. And you see this level of thoughtfulness and the vision of each person in the room just open up and widen. And there's much more coordination. It's not as chaotic. And in the debrief, what often comes out of it is students say, if I just slowed down a bit, and I just pushed my vision a little bit wider, I can see what's going on. We say, yeah, because when you're in the weeds, when you're constantly on the dance floor, you sometimes don't rise to that level of, what are we doing here? What's the point, right? What's the balcony view?
Yes.
At the same time, if you're not in the weeds of things, then your high level view might be misinformed, or it might be missing other perspectives. So this is an example of like a leadership training exercise where I'm often trying to invite dissonance in students' minds. I'm trying to put them in spaces where they have to see and feel the change that's needed and not just intellectualize about it. And I think that that order is really important. When students experience a concept that we might want to educate about before we intellectualize about it, then they end up really owning the concept afterwards. Like, wow, I experienced the very thing we're now talking about. It sinks in more deeply, and I get emails from students a year or two later saying, wow, that I'm still... You know, you were talking a lot about having frequent, trust-filled communication with others and making that part of one's daily routine. And that, remember that exercise we did where we all had to get in bobsled shapes? I thought it was weird at the time, but that's I actually figured out that's my everyday work life. And also, one of my favorite things to hear is when people say, oh, my personal life has been affected too. You know, one of the improv tenets is yes and. This is very well known now, but I've had students reach out and say, you know, I thought you were just talking about affirming and building with others in the workplace, but I really realized I need to do that with my kids too. When my kids showed me something on their iPad they're interested in, formerly I may have gone, yeah. But now I go, oh, I'm going to yes and this. Hey, what's this game? What's going on? And they get excited that the parent is seeking to build communication with them around something versus just negate it, which is... can become a chronic habit if you're parenting, because we say no a lot, right?
Right. By the way, we're about halfway through already. Time flies when you're having
time flies.
Yes. This is WGTD-FM. We're on Education Matters. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler, and we are interviewing Dan Weissenen, professor in the Baruch College CUNY Marx School of Public and International Affairs. And he is an expert in communication, leadership, and improvisation, teaches and consults around the world. And we're learning something about what he does in this short amount of time that we have together. We'll also post links to his websites on our program page. So hard to know where to pick up next, Don, but something that's been lurking in the back of my brain, so I guess I should ask it, is, you know, I've been trained in Augusta Boal's Theater of the Oppressed. And for those not familiar with it, you know, Augusta Boal is a Brazilian theater director, now has departed us, but has been quite prolific in his writing, and in his influence around the world has been tremendous. He does things called image theater, forum theater, legislative theater, which I know is
theater,
particular interest to you, and something called aesthetic theater. We, you know, there's many things, Rainbow of Desire. I find his work enormously enriching and applicable to my work in conflict. And I'm just wondering, do you draw it all from his work, or do you contrast yours to his?
I do. And actually, I would say in many ways, the threads that I've been, it really builds, it's a big yes and to Boal in a way. And there have been others who picked up on this as well, such as Josh Lerner had a book called Making Democracy Fun. Where he sort of starting with Boal's work, he says that, you know, he asked the question, first of all, where's an area of life that people just volunteer countless hours to already? They're unpaid. They want to do it all the time if they can when they're not working. Right. And he said that area of life is games. It's games. I mean, my son right now is, you know, they're playing Roblox and things like that, summer vacation, and they're just having a great time building these worlds with their friends online, right? Games, whether it's computer games or other types of games, right, are engaging. They're fun, right? And so he asked this question. I love it. And it really comes out of the Boal strain of things of how could we make democracy a bit more like that? Why is it that for many people, doing democracy, political work is often seen as they're apathetic about it, or they're disengaged, or, you know, they're the usual processes for working with fellow citizens, collaborating, just don't seem interesting enough, or right. Mm-hmm. So this comes out of that too. And mm-hmm. I think one of the pitfalls here is to go, well, let's make all democracy fun. And, you know, some people might see that as pithy or, you know, as minimizing the importance of this. I actually think it's the exact opposite. We have enough serious going on. We need to find new ways to have people work together. Right. And, you know, it's interesting, even for the educators listening to this program, even the U.S. Department of Education has emphasized this. They had a report saying that narrow conceptions of civic education are just not going to be enough. The traditional ways we have civics classes in high schools and just traditional ways we've been doing this have not worked well. Mm. And, you know, this report said that we need to figure out ways to reinvent civic education for the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And I think Bowal and that whole, all those streams are one way to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Even former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had a website she started called iCivics that was about teaching civics, but through games and things like that. So there's been a lot of little things, bright spots in this appearing around the world.
Yes.
And I think it's time to really thread them together and find new ways of doing this that are engaging for all people.
Great. And speaking of bright spots, I listened to a recent talk that you gave at Columbia. Beth Fisher Yoshida was hosting, and you named five. I'm not going to ask you to name all five, but five exemplary programs or initiatives that kind of demonstrate the power of this improvisational approach to communication and development. And I'm wondering if you could maybe mention one or two.
Sure. I have to start. There's really two that seem to develop independently, but doing the same thing, was working with police and young people, both in the Netherlands, the city of Gouda, as well as in New York. Mm. And I actually start the book with the example of the Netherlands. There was a great deal of animosity that had developed probably about a decade ago between Dutch Moroccan youth in the Netherlands in the city of Gouda and the police force, to the point where these young people, they were, you know, seen, the police saw them as standing on the side of the street doing no good, yelling insults at the police. And it was one of these things where the conflict just spiraled to the point where restaurants in the city were no longer letting the young people come into them. And Barnett Pierce and many others have talked about communication as patterned, right? Life is actually very patterned. We have a hard time seeing it because we're so enmeshed in communication, but it's very patterned. Like someone says something negative to us, we say something negative to them, back to them, and so on and so forth. And now we're stuck in this A-B pattern, right? And that plays out in international relations. It plays out in cities, right? So the interaction between the police and youth, negativity, spiraling downward. And so facilitators were brought in to try to bring the groups together for dialogues and many things that are known in fields of conflict resolution to work well. And as the unique part of the intervention was they brought in folks from improv theaters to have the young people and police play improv games with each other. And what I love about this is exactly what you would expect. The young people were like, oh, this is stupid. We don't need to be doing this. And the police were like, improv, what are you talking about? This is silly. But they said, just go with us. Just do it. Like, we're just, you know, over several sessions, they started having such a great time playing these games together that there's these actual interviews of police saying, I was released of my negativity toward these young people. And one of my favorite things they did, they created improvised exercises where the young people would have to dress up as police for a day, and the police would have to dress up as the young people, and they switched roles in the city. And they said, just perform a different scene here with the police. And they had such a fun time seeing each other in the different roles that nothing but laughter and empathy really came out of that.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, being stuck in these inflexible, rigid positions and roles, improv gave them a way to release themselves of that, to try something different, to make a new choice. And I think that's fundamentally what this is all about. Mm-hmm. The Irondale Theater in Brooklyn, New York, I also have to recognize, has done similar things with police and young people. And so that's an example of just one one or two bright spots that I think have been significant and point us toward the kind of futures that we need ultimately.
And you do, you mentioned the words new choice, and that's an exercise that you do sometimes. Could you describe that exercise?
I've heard people say this exercise is the heart of all improv. So I'm glad you're highlighting it. Yeah. So this would be in a theatrical scene, two improvisers would get up and one person would say, you know, hey, good to be with you here at the Eiffel Tower. And the other person would yes and that yes. And I brought my French flag. I felt like that would be the thing to do, right? And they would build off each other. But then someone, a coach, would say new choice at any point, right? And they would have to revise what they just asserted to something new. You know, new choice. Hey, I brought my flag. New choice. Hey, I brought you a microwave dinner, right? And they would have to, they might have to update it more or, but just so you know how profound, it seems simple, right? But getting people to unlock themselves from chosen courses of action. To start with where we started today, to tell a new story, to let every story or statement you make be revisable is probably one of the most significant interventions we can make with human beings. And I have heard my good friend, Gary Kramer, who runs the National Comedy Theater in San Diego, has a program called Unscripted Learning that he runs with one of his improvisers, is also a behavioral specialist, and they wrote a book recently, I'm forgetting the name, but it talks about their interventions with teenagers with autism. And he talks about this being an exercise that they've had parents use with teenagers on the spectrum to try to unstick them from going down narrow mental avenues. So even at home, parents practicing this exercise with autistic youth will say, you know, new choice randomly to get them off the scripts they're on. So improv gives us the opportunity to unscript and re-script life in really significant ways.
I love that new choice exercise. I saw you facilitating it on one YouTube video somewhere, and I noticed the moments that you chose to ask people to make a new choice. And I don't know whether it was serendipitous or whether this is how you roll, probably a little of both. But what I saw was that somebody would fall into self-blaming or other blaming or just a dead end. And that's when you came in with the suggestion for a new choice.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm also thinking, sorry, just on a little bit of a roll here, and then I'll toss it back to you. But something that we're both familiar with is systemic questioning or circular questioning, which has to do with, you know, inviting people to consider different contexts, different perspectives, different possibilities. And I can just imagine a nice marriage between new choice and that type of questioning. Exactly how that would unfold, we don't have time for, but I intuitively see a connection there.
I do, and I would say my one piece of feedback for circular questioning is just that it is often done in a very kind of heady intellect. It gets at the cognitive level of new choices you could make for conflicts. I think the addition here, the yes and to that, is we also think about new choice in terms of behavioral and emotional choices, affective choices. So we'll even say new emotion, right? So someone's going to, very angry emotions, like new emotion, try something new, what would it be to laugh this off a bit? What would it be to feel courageous where you don't feel brave? Or, you know, that is, I think that's the beauty of this too, is the choices can take place on many levels that aren't just new words,
right?
New nonverbals, right? And people go, what I have seen with this work is that people feel freed. They feel freed to peel off the layers that have formed and make new choices on many different levels of their lives.
Oh, fantastic. Now, this work that you do, does it have a process quality to it, meaning that the games that you play and the exercises that you do have an arc where, you know, some are beginning and some are more developed and
yes,
there's an end point?
Oh yeah, and that's that is the other reason I wrote Improv for Democracy was to, mm-hmm. after years of having experimented, tested with these, what's the sequence here, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot throw someone into an advanced improv exercise out of nowhere, and they'll often, I found in trainings and teaching, speaking to that really sets mm-hmm. people at ease. By everybody, this is going to be a safe and brave space. Don't worry, it's going to be super easy. You know, 6 weeks from now, we're going to keep upping the stakes. But it's very important for people unfamiliar with these methods mm-hmm. and concepts mm-hmm. To not start in an advanced place. Just to give mm-hmm. you an example of, you know, 6 weeks into sort of leadership performance training, I'll have, and I got this from a guy named Stevie Ray, I adapted it. I'll have five students sit at a table and I'll say, okay, we're going to send one person out. And the person coming back in is going to deliver bad news. And we often make it a funny thing, first of all. It's just like, you know, it's not like a real thing just to warm them up. But they have to deliver bad news to these four people at the table. And the four people at the table are going to fight back and ask questions and be mad and all this. And it's about how this person handles all the critiques and negativity directed toward them. As a leadership training exercise, what do you do with that? And in that situation, do you get angry back at them? Well, that's probably not going to work, right? So I would never put people in that exercise on week one. It's too right. much. But right. by week six, they're ready for it. You'd be amazed. They've worked up to it and they're feeling yeah. more confident. And, you know, so that is really important to this work.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I'm. Let's do a little role play here. I'm an ombudsperson. I'm new in this role, and this is true at the university where I work. And it's very exciting, very challenging, demanding work. But I sometimes find myself stuck with, say, an administrator and a faculty member. Often the pattern is one where the faculty member is petitioning the administrator, and the administrator is just kind of sitting on it. Is just kind of saying, well, this isn't really that important, or I'll get back to you someday. Mm-hmm. And I keep hearing from the faculty member that this is, they're being stonewalled, and what can I do? And this is important. Yeah. And so maybe I'm giving you a super difficult challenge, but I thought it would be fun to have something.
Sure. The key thing I picked up on there was this isn't important as a starting point, right? That's mm-hmm. the opposite of yes and. Mm-hmm. So just to clarify for everybody, yes and doesn't mean agreement. Mm-hmm. I have to agree with everything people say. No. And this mm-hmm. is one tool amongst many we can use, but it's a really good one. Mm-hmm. Yes and is affirming the reality that is being offered to you, first of all. It's not agreeing with it, but it is seeking to affirm the offer. Mm-hmm. And then see if you can build on it first as a starting point. So as the ombudsperson, you know, this might be a little bit of advice to the administrator, but it would be this person's concerns aren't coming from nowhere, right? Right? There's like legitimate motivations at this, right? So could we have a starting point of just articulating what their concerns are, of recognizing the offer that's being made before we try to figure out where to go with this, right? Many people, by the way, are familiar with microaggressions and things like that from the DEI literature. Mm-hmm. There's a parallel concept in that literature called micro-invalidations, which is all the ways we invalidate the realities that people are offering us all day long. Right? So from a starting point of, I invalidate what you're offering versus, I'm going to seek to affirm what you're offering here. And now let's see where we can go with this, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that would be imperative in this situation. And also, maybe from the faculty member as well, is there a way that they're just writing off the administrator and their concerns right from the beginning, mm-hmm. right? So a little bit of acknowledgement of each other's perspectives, just as a beginning point, without even getting to differences or mm-hmm. working through things, I think is key. Mm. The other thing, the last thing I'd offer on this is that I think there's a term I came up with for the Improv for Democracy book I call reframe the game. And so as ombudsperson, I would ask everybody, what kind of game do we typically play here? Well, the game is debate, right? Or hunker down in our positions, right? There's speaking to that work of what is the episode taking place, there's a higher level context under which our content is making sense or not making sense to us. I call that a game, right? There's a game operating. So what would it be to reframe the game? Every improv game and exercise fundamentally reframes the typical games we might play, right? And just as a quick example, I have an exercise where it's called, and this is from, goes back to Spolin, last word, first word. Two people have a conversation. The last word the other person says must be the first word of the sentence in response. And they keep doing this. And this is to highlight the difference between the game people typically play, which is someone says something, I'm going to wait until they finish speaking, and then I'm going to slam them with this preformed opinion I have in my head, versus really following the other person where they were and trying to build on that.
Right.
So, you know, listening to hear versus listening to understand.
Yes.
When we do that exercise, I say now we're playing a different game than many of us usually play, which is truly listening to follow and build versus listening to react. And so in this ombudsperson situation, I wonder what we could name the game typically played is between faculty and administrator and ask if we could reframe that to a different game. A different game might be, we would normally do this as debate. Could we truly do this as a game of dialogue where I'm going to try to paraphrase back to you what you're saying before I even make my points? Right. There's many different ways to go at this, but I think those are the kinds of interventions that you could make.
That's fantastic. What great advice. How much do I owe you for that?
It's free. It's free.
Okay. Since we're winding down, and this has been a fantastic conversation, I can't believe that it's gone by so quickly. I just want to give a plug for your book, which we've mentioned a few times now, Improv for Democracy, How to Bridge Differences and Develop the Communication and Leadership Skills Our World Needs by Don Weissen. And I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It is so rich and packed full of insights and practical advice. Almost every other page has a game or a practice that you can immediately implement in your own classroom. So very, very highly recommended. And I also want to mention, since Barnett Pierce's name came up during this conversation, that he was my mentor in graduate school. I wrote a book under his tutelage, and there are two books that he wrote that I would mention right off the top of my head if people want to enlarge their perspective on communication and its possibilities. One is Communication and the Human Condition, and another one is Making Better Social Worlds. I think I got the title correct.
Making Social Worlds.
Just Making Social Worlds.
Yeah.
Right. Right. The better is implied, but yes, Making Social Worlds. And is there anything as we wind down here, Don, that you would like to underline or call our attention to?
Yeah. Sure. And I think, you know, I'm just going to build this. This is a yes and to Barnett Pierce, who we both mutually draw from. And by the way, that book, Making Social Worlds, just for everybody listening, I mean, talk about someone, you know, 30, 40 years of work summed up. That book is in my top five. And I, after I read it, I have never ceased to look at the world differently. it's that kind of book. It's such a special work. But, you know, even in that book, Barnett Pierce says that, you know, our humanity has made such incredible advances in areas from medicine to science and technology. And it's been exponential, right? You just look at the developments out there. We have not made the same advances in our understandings and practices for communication, which is the fundamental thing that we do as human beings, right? You can see the old ways of communicating, the old forms and types, just in so much of what happens in a lot of public discourse. And as educators, I think educators are uniquely positioned to push communication skills, social skills, emotional learning skills, no matter what you're teaching, into that same kind of space as we've had in other areas of life. So
that's such an inspiring vision, Don, and such a good note to end on. This has been Don Weissenen on communication, leadership, and improvisation. We'll post his website on our page. And thank you for listening to WGTD FM. This has been Education Matters with Jonathan Shaler.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be exploring one of the most troubling topics before the public today.